Welcome to the RepChat Inside Stories series, conversations with creative talent and creative entrepreneurial businesses. We discover the inside stories that inspire and motivate creative people to do what they do. So in the RepChat virtual studio today, I am very happy to invite Jean Montarastelli, who is a Brooklyn-based EFT practitioner who helps small business owners from all over the world to eliminate self-sabotage. He's the editor of tappingq&a.com and the host of Tapping Q&A podcast. He loves to help experienced practitioners and total newbies, and he has a provocative approach as to tapping to get the most out of this healing experience. So he's here with me today. Hi, Jean.
How are you today?
I'm very well, thank you, Jean. And I'm really excited about this conversation. And one of the reasons is I love tapping. I find it such a useful, simple, pragmatic tool just to help in life. And so when you agreed to do this podcast, I was really, really happy. So I'd like to ask you, what is tapping?
Yeah, so tapping is a tool. It, you know, one of the ways the shorthand people often use for it is they'll say it is a psychological acupuncture. But the really, really nice thing about it is it doesn't require any needles at all. Basically, what we're doing is we're leveraging the exact same system that acupuncture uses. And if we have discovered that if we stimulate these particular points, we can measure cortisol levels being dropped in the body. We can see it in the blood. We can see it in the saliva. And so it's a mechanical process. That's one of the things I really love about it is, you know, I don't have to have an understanding or a belief in an aspirin for it to deal with my pain. It's just mechanical. It goes into the body and it does its job. Tapping is very similar. It is something that is a mechanical process. So when we tap on these points that you can find on the body very, very easily, what it does is it brings down the biochemicals around the emotion that we're feeling in that particular moment. And so in a short-term way, it becomes really great in the moment to get you to feel better. We oftentimes refer to that as triage. I'm feeling something in the moment. It brings down the sadness, the overwhelm, the disappointment. But in a more comprehensive way, what it allows us to do is it allows us to actually deal with memory consolidation. Memory consolidation is where you're able to actually go into the programs and patterns that you have in your subconscious mind and change them into something that is useful. People at times are wondering, are we tapping things in? Are we tapping things out? And we're not doing either of those things. For my mind, what we're doing is we're just trying to create a proportionate, well-informed emotional response. So as I sit in my apartment here in Brooklyn, New York, there is a lion that is in the Central Park Zoo that is 6.8 miles away from me. Now, it is good that I'm afraid of lions, but if I was so afraid of lions that I didn't leave my apartment, that would be a disproportionate response. If when I'm done with this, I walk into my kitchen and a mouse runs across the floor and I jump on the table and I scream like a five-year-old, that's a misinformed response. In both cases, fear is trying to keep me safe, but it's not showing up in the right way. It's either too big or it's misinformed about what the problem is. And so when we're tapping, we actually have the opportunity to go into the beliefs that we have about ourselves, about the world, about how things are, and we get to transform them into being accurate so that after I tap on my fear of lions, I'm not going to go jump in the lion cage, but I will comfortably get on the subway and go to Central Park and go up to the front of the cage, knowing that I'm safe on the outside. So what I'm doing is I'm taking this internal fear, which is just a piece of information in my subconscious mind, and I'm transforming it. And so the application of that is anytime we have a disproportionate misinformed response, we can transform that. That could be, I'm afraid to speak up at a meeting because the people on my team are going to judge me. Or when I look at myself in the mirror and I don't like the person that I see, those are beliefs about the world that are disproportionate or misinformed. And so the tool gives us the ability to reduce the emotion that we're feeling in the moment through the tapping, changing the biochemistry of the body, which then gives us direct access to go in there and transform these thoughts in simple, subtle ways that then just have rippling effects through every interaction that we can have in our lives.
That's a fascinating response. And I know that the original name was emotional freedom technique. So people think, oh, well, we just tap on the emotions. But you mentioned also beliefs and thoughts. So what is the range of things that you can tap on, Jean?
Well, to get our history correct, mm-hmm. emotional freedom technique was actually the first version of the popular single algorithm of this. That's actually not where tapping started. Tapping started more prominently from someone by the name of Dr. Roger Callahan. He created something called thought field therapy. So for him, he was dealing with thoughts. One of his students, Gary Craig, who created emotional freedom technique, was responding to the sense of emotion. And so for me, like, it's not that we want to be free of our emotions, but again, to have a proportionate emotional response. And so when we're able to transform this, so one of the simple ways that I use tapping every single day is I sit down at my desk and I look at my to-do list and I imagine myself doing every single thing on my to-do list. Now, on any given day, the three most valuable tasks on my to-do list are more important to me and my business than the rest of my to-do list combined. But because they're the three most important tasks, there might be stakes involved. I want to ask someone to joint venture with me. I want someone to hire me to work with them, and their fear that's inside of that. And so if I let my fear get the best of me, then what I do is I end up spending a lot of time in the middle of my to-do list, doing things that feel emotionally safe, but are kind of important. And so basically all I do is I just imagine myself doing a task. I pay attention to the resistance and the emotion that comes up inside of me, and I transform that and I reduce it so that all of a sudden, everything on my to-do list feels emotionally safe. And so tangibly, the way it shows up is for the first couple of hours of my day in my business, I'm doing the really valuable things first. And I wish this data has been lost to time, but I wish I could see my web stats from when I started doing this practice of tapping every single moment, every single morning, because it literally transformed my business. Because even if I've just felt emotionally safe for 90 minutes at the beginning of the day, I did those two or three really valuable tasks, and you could just see downloads to the podcast, visits to my website just exploded at that time. Because I was feeling comfortable to sharing what I have, because I recognized it was okay if someone said no to me. And so instead of going, boy, I really wish I could share this with the world, I'm like, I'm going to go share it and whoever likes it's going to like it. And that's going to be great. And so just by making that one simple, small change to my resistance to taking action, transformed my life very, very quickly. You know, the way I originally found my way to tapping was trying to manage my own social anxiety. I could stand on stage in front of 8,000 people and it was as easy as breathing. And I couldn't answer my own phone. I couldn't ask for help in a store. I couldn't speak up in public. And so dealing with and transforming that radically changed my life, because all of a sudden, simple daily interactions that you might find very comfortable went from being super uncomfortable for me to just being par for the course, which immediately opened my life, which immediately opened my interaction, because my social anxiety was showing up even in close friendships. So it wasn't like, it wasn't about meeting new people. It was about being social in general. And so all of a sudden, having that stripped away, I was in a circumstance where spending more time with people I really liked. That immediately improved the richness of my life. And so it's any place that we have a belief about the way the world works that isn't accurate, that is holding us back, it's a great tool to transform that, that allows us to just engage with the day in a radically different way, even with these small little changes.
So, you know, you've had a personal experience of how it's transformed your life. I'd be very interested to know a little bit of the story of how you found it. You know, did you come across a practitioner yourself, or what was the pathway?
Yeah. So I was dealing with the social anxiety thing, and there was a book launch that was happening. And as part of the book launch, the author did 6 weekly teleclasses leading up the launch to get excitement, to get everybody to buy the book. And in one of those classes, he interviewed a tapping practitioner. I was traveling a lot at that point in my life. I downloaded these teleclasses to my iPad. I had a layover in the Pittsburgh airport. I had 2 hours and I literally was just walking laps around the airport just to move and just listening to these interviews. And at the beginning of the conversation, I knew nothing about tapping. At the end of the conversation, I knew less. But there was something inside of me that went, huh, that's really, really interesting. So I went online, and like you'd mentioned earlier, Gary Craig, at the time, Gary Craig had a free manual in teaching you how to tap. So I downloaded it and I started playing with it. And within 3 weeks, my social anxiety was gone. And at that point, I kind of went, huh, this is fascinating. I should pay attention to this a little bit more. And it was at that point, I just really kind of threw myself into it, trying to consume as much as I could training-wise to get as better as I could. And initially, it was just for fun. Like, there are lots of people in the world who say they have a business and what they really have is a hobby. Mm-hmm. I was just the opposite. I had an article published in a newsletter about one of my experiences. A bunch of people started emailing me. So I created a question and answer website. And just started answering questions because it's fun. I love answering questions. I love teaching. I love sharing my experience. And 9 months into it, someone sent me an email saying, can you please sell stuff so I can buy it? Because they felt bad about all of the good free content they were getting from me. 6 months later, someone sent me an email saying, do you do phone sessions? I really like your style. And I'm like, oh, right. This is business. This isn't a hobby. And at that point, kind of went, yeah, absolutely. I need to really approach this in a radically different way. But initially, like, it just sprung from my own personal curiosity. I'm a natural learner, mm-hmm. and my own sharing with other people because I'm a natural teacher, and just kind of sharing as I wandered the world going, oh my gosh, this is this really cool thing. I'd love, like, someone's complaining about a headache or an upset stomach or feeling overwhelmed. I'm like, this is the weirdest thing in the world. Let me show you this really weird thing. And it just kind of just grew out of my own experience and my own enthusiasm into something that became so much larger than I ever dreamed.
Well, I have listened to some of your podcasts and I have attended some of your sessions, and there's the generosity that you're sharing of your experiences and the imagination and the creativity. See, RebCat is a storytelling organization. We listen to people's stories, mm-hmm. we write stories, and I'm very interested in what your take on the narrative, because, you know, sometimes our narrative doesn't really support us. The past memories and that kind of thing. What's your experience of transforming narratives, personal narratives, not books that people write?
Yeah. So, and you don't know this. So this isn't a setup, but this is really where I am right now. Somewhere in the next couple of months, I'm actually going to be doing a weekend event on how we identify ourselves. And that ID and how that impacts us. Because for transformation to happen, we either have to change the way we see ourselves, the way we see the world, or the way we see both. Because whatever my operative reality is, that is reality. You know, so for example, my social anxiety, the story my subconscious mind told me was I was just someone's kid brother that they were letting to tag along and they were tolerating me. So that was the story that my internal guidance system was telling when I was hanging out with others. And that's why it was so uncomfortable, is because there was a part of me that was saying, you don't belong here. They are tolerating you. And so all of the choices we make, we're making out of stories, the way we understand ourselves, the way we understand the world, and the way we understand how those two things work together. You know, on a very, very simple level, you know, I'm afraid to speak in public because people are going to think I'm stupid. I'm going to stutter. I'm going to mess up. That's a self-defining story. I'm not good at this thing. And then we also have collective generalizations that are identification parts as well. You know, the men in my family are blah, 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 blah. You know how Italians are. Like, we choose these generalizations, and as a shorthand to help us to navigate the world, like, that's the way the subconscious mind works, is it finds cause and effect relationships that are useful. 7,000 years ago, we saw giant paw prints and we thought, ooh, fuzzy thing with giant teeth this direction, I'm going to go the other direction. So there's a story of how we understand the world. And so our subconscious mind is constantly creating these stories about ourselves, about the world and how it works. But what it does is the subconscious mind is very, very black and white in its approach. The subconscious mind does not deal with nuance very well. And so when we start these stories about ourselves that are generalizations, men in my family are never lucky in love. Well, if that's the story that I'm telling as I step into the world, then I'm going to assume the worst in any sort of romantic interaction because my identification is someone who is not lucky in love. So even if I try really hard, so I immediately start undermining and sabotaging myself, because if certain doom is coming in this relationship, I might as well get it done sooner than later. And I'm going to find ways to get in the way of that. You know, all of the self-sabotaging that we do are misguided internal beliefs about how the world works. And we're just operating out of those in order to keep ourselves safe.
So it goes right into the internal kind of manual, the way that we make up our reality, and it starts to reorganize that.
And so again, like just really, really simple things where like I didn't have to think about every single relationship, but when I identified the fact that when I'm spending time with people, they're not tolerating me, but some people actually enjoy my company, all of a sudden my choices became different. I was no longer like hemming and hawing when I was invited to go somewhere. I was no longer 30 minutes in, like looking for an exit so I could get out of there without finding my way of saying something dumb. So I wasn't like thinking about these interactions in a different way, but because I saw myself as someone who actually was worthy of being in other people's company, my choices immediately changed in a radically different way. You know, when I work with business owners all the time who are in the transformational space, and we have the story that salespeople are sleazy, and mm-hmm. what I have is this amazing gift. And when I'm able to transform an internal belief from I should be giving this away and sales is sleazy to the belief that sales is service, that when I share something that is really valuable to you, I'm actually doing you a great service because I'm giving you the opportunity to change your life. And my favorite definition of sales is it's just an exchange of enthusiasm. You're enthusiastic about transformation. The way you show that is the money you pay. I'm enthusiastic about you having transformation. The way I show up with that is I give you my skills, my talent, and my expertise, and there's an exchange inside of that. And so when I'm able to switch that internal belief system about how I approach sales around transformational work, all of a sudden I start making radically different choices. Like all of a sudden I'm just like in a conversation and someone's like, I'm like, hey, you know, I actually do this thing. If you're interested, we could have a conversation about it and not being pushy about it. But if I think sales is sleazy, I'm probably not going to say that to a stranger because I don't think it's going to go well. So by, again, changing this internal belief about, in this case, how the world works, sales equals sleazy, sales equals used car salesman, sales equals whatever. And I change that into sales can be service, then immediately I act in a different way. And all of a sudden I'm naturally acting in a different way because I see myself in the world differently.
So it's a kind of like taking away the roadblocks to really being available for people. So there's this narrative, and there's also real circumstances that happen. Mm-hmm. I mean, think about the world over the last 2 years. We've been in lockdowns, we've been socially distanced. Yeah. How has this affected your practice over the last 2 years, working with, I guess, all the situations that we've dealt with?
On a micro level, it hasn't changed it at all, because the work I'm always doing is just like, where are you now? What would you like to be doing that you're not? Where would you like to be? And so the reason for not taking action, the reason for the overwhelm, the reason for the practical obstacles in the world, every single person that's nuanced and unique, the process itself isn't any different. The tangible difference is the subconscious mind wants the predictable. The subconscious mind will even choose the predictably bad over the unpredictable because it's manageable. I know what's coming. I know what tools are in my tool belt. I know how to deal with this particular thing. And so typically the only time we make change is when we're really, really close to a new outcome or we hit rock bottom, like my social anxiety. Like my world was getting smaller and smaller and that was painful, but that was okay. The moment that I started making choices that I was harming the people in my life where they were counting on me to show up, I wasn't showing up, and then lying about that because I felt uncomfortable in that circumstance, that was my rock bottom moment. So now I was in a deep amount of pain because it was one thing to wreck my own life. It's a completely another thing to wreck the people around me. So that became this moment to step out. So when we're in the tolerable middle, we will pay lip service to change, but the subconscious mind wants the predictable, even the predictably bad, because we could make things so much worse. When we have significant upheaval, be it in our personal life, you know, a relationship ends, a job ends, a loved one dies, we move to a new place, it gives us the opportunity to let go of the habits of the tolerable middle and examine the transformation we want to make. And so because the last 2 years has upended the nature of the way we work and how we are in the world and where we can be and how we can be around others, because that upheaval is so large, like you're seeing it in the job market where lots and lots of people are leaving jobs because they're recognizing, oh, life is fragiler, more fleeting, or more difficult than I thought. I should be making choices that I really love versus choices that I tolerate. And so the amount of obstacle in daily life is, maybe it's more, maybe it's less. But because it's such a radical reorientation, because we've had to reset so many things, many more people are asking the question about, okay, who do I want to be and how do I want to be in the world? What is the story, like you say, that I want to be telling about myself in the world? And because there is this big thing, I mean, you know, it's storytelling 101. There is my life, I'm going along, and then some initializing event shows up that causes me to recalibrate what is going on. And that could be in a drama, the death of a loved one, in the fantasy, the showing up of a giant dragon. But it's something that causes us to reevaluate what is going on because we recognize what we were doing before is not giving us the same outcome because there has been some change, either a change in the environment or a change the way we see the world. Therefore, we now start going on this journey and trying to learn and earn new lessons to transform into something else. So I think one of the things that is done in conscious and unconscious ways is it's created a lot more seeking and questioning about our place in the world, about the stories that we're telling ourselves. And so the nature of that work is no different than it has been at any point in human history. The fact that we have this moment that's shining such a bright light on, is this the right fit for me or not? Because I'm given the opportunity to question because of the upheaval. That is the change that I'm seeing.
So for most of this conversation, we've talked about the one-on-one, but I know you work with groups as well, Gene.
Absolutely.
So what's your experience of working on kind of collective anxieties and fears and fear of this, that, another?
Yeah. So, I mean, I don't know if it's necessarily that we're working, I don't know if I'm necessarily working on the collective, but working on lots of individuals inside of the collective changes a collective. But one of the really powerful things that happens in group work is we get the opportunity to recognize the fact that our experience is less unique than we think. One of the reasons why oftentimes we don't talk about what we are going through is we feel like we're the only one. I can remember the very first time. So I have a number of learning disabilities. And in addition to the work that we were talking about for the last 25 years, I've done lots and lots of work with young people. And I work with a buddy of mine. We combine juggling, sketch, comedy, drama in our work with young people as a way of engaging them. And I can remember the very first time I told the story about my learning disabilities and I used a straitjacket escape as part of the illustration for that particular thing. And we were 1,700 young people in the Atlanta, Georgia area. And the evening ended and 15 young people lined up to talk to me after the fact. And all 15 of them said the exact same thing. They said, I thought I was the only one, where they're talking about some non-visible thing that they were struggling with. And they had me to connect with. And the thing that did not cross their mind was that the 14 other young people in line were also resonating with me in the same way. I'm sure they were thinking, oh, these people just want a picture with Gene because he did this really cool straitjacket escape. But they didn't even recognize their other peers who wanted to say the exact same thing to me, because literally all 15 of them said, I thought I was the only one. And so one of the things that happens when we do work in a group setting is it gives us the opportunity to normalize an experience so that we can do some transformation in what is going on, but inside of that community, we've now created permission to talk about those things in a public way. You know, one of the things as we see the change of, you know, very particularly the definition of what masculinity is in this world is that, you know, for 2.5 years, I taught anger management at county jail, and I was working with lower socioeconomic urban men who lived in a culture in which the only negative emotion that they were allowed to have was anger, unless one of their parents or one of their grandparents died. Then they were allowed to be sad for a short period of time. But otherwise, every other negative emotion was seen as weakness. So culturally, they were trained to channel all of their negative emotions into anger because that was the one that was culturally appropriate. And so when we start to change what is culturally normative about the way we talk about our emotions, then it gives us the opportunity not to be bottling things up, to feel connected, to create transformation. And so if we're working in a group and we talk about fear and we start to recognize, oh my gosh, she is dealing with this in her family, like I'm dealing with this in my family, now I don't feel isolated. So I'm giving myself permission to talk about it a little more, which is a healthier approach. And I might even have found an ally who's in the exact same circumstance where it's more than just in passing, but being able to find support inside of that. And so oftentimes doing things in a group is super powerful. And one of the things I do is once a month, I teach a class where I teach a new technique. And this month we were doing work on generational healing. So I teach an idea, I teach a tool, and then I do a demonstration before I send folks off in the small group to try what I'm teaching. And the demonstration that we did of generational work around chronic illness, the 39 other people who were on the call that was not me leading it and was not the person who was doing the demonstration were just flooding the chat box with insights and transformations and affirmations of their own experience, because for 10 minutes, they got to hear someone clearly speak out loud what they're experiencing and how it is showing up. And it's like, gives vocabulary and normalizes and makes it easier. So I think one of the real powers of doing something like that is eliminating the isolation. The other thing that happens is when we're hearing from other people's experiences, oftentimes we get vocabulary for our struggle that we didn't have. Like the number of times I'll say something to a client, it's like, oh my gosh, that's exactly what it is. And I couldn't find the words to describe that thing. Is that by doing something collectively, we also get the opportunity not only to see that we're not alone, but oftentimes describe our own experience in a way that we didn't know that's exactly what was going on. There was something that wasn't right. Now I know how to describe it because you shared with me your struggle. I'm like, yes, that's exactly what I'm experiencing.
So the development of our own emotional literacy, our articulating of things, which, you know, we know hurt and maybe feel stuck, but we find language and vocabulary. Is there anything that you wouldn't use tapping on, Gene?
Well, I mean, the nice thing about tapping is it takes very little time and it doesn't cost you anything really to do it. And so, you know, the question I'm always asking my students, the question I'm always asking my clients is, how's it working for you? You know, like for example, I one time, my website is called Tapping Q&A. People send me questions. I want questions. I record podcasts on questions. And I'm like, ask me your question so I can be helpful. And one time I got a question from someone who said, because of choices I've made through my life, basically my adult teeth have rotten out. Is it possible to grow another set of adult teeth?
Wow.
And I'm like, okay, I have never thought about that. And I'm like, great. So when I'm approaching something, there's always two steps to it. The first is the emotion about the circumstance. So before we even consider the possibility of doing something like that, obviously there's emotional distress in your life. Let's respond to the emotional distress. So in every single circumstance, there's the emotion about the circumstance that we are in. And so I love starting with the emotion about the issue before the issue. Then I said, well, this is the way I would approach it. I have no idea if it would work. But again, if you are sitting here thinking for 15 minutes and tapping on your body, wanting healing and transformation to happen, it's probably not the worst investment of 15 minutes of time. I certainly over the weekend invested 15 minutes of time in much, much less productive ways than trying to tap to grow a third row of teeth, even if that feels to you and I something that might be a little fanciful. And so that's the approach to it, is like, how's it working for you? I'm so undogmatic about the tool set. Adam Hermosia, who runs gyms and is now a business leader and teaches folks how to grow businesses, in his book, $100 Million Offer, said something that I just love so much. And the line was, don't be romantic about how you solve the problem, solve the problem. And so it's not about doing it my way or doing it the best way. Like, my approach does not matter. What matters is, am I able to offer you something that is useful? And so as we approach a tool set like this, great, give it a try. So like, tapping is a tool that you can work with almost anything on. Like, it is being used through with veterans on PTSD. Mm-hmm. Just really profound, deep things. It is an amazing tool set for dissociated identity disorder. But just because the tool set is good for it doesn't mean that we should be doing it. So the thing that I would not be using tapping on is the thing that I'm not qualified for. If I'm not qualified to work with an issue without tapping, tapping does not qualify me to work on that particular issue. So it's just like, you know, taking out an appendix makes someone healthier. Doesn't mean I should be the one sticking a knife into someone's belly. Like, even if I have great drawings and instruction knowing how to do it, that's not a place I belong because I'm not trained and qualified to do that. And so if we are dealing with issues of trauma, from violence, from sexual trauma, from war, if we're dealing with things of mental illness that is not appropriate for us to be a helper in that circumstance, adding tapping to our tool belt does not make us appropriate for that. So it's more an issue of appropriateness of care, not is an issue right or wrong for tapping.
2022, what have you got in store for 2022, Gene?
So I call my jug. So I have a jug of water in my fridge, 64 ounces that I want to drink every single day. And so every single day as I go into the kitchen and I refill this glass that I have here in my right hand, I call the jug of water my Y jar. And the reason why I call it my Y jar is when I fill my glass up, I say out loud the reason why I am sitting at my desk. And the reason why I sit at my desk is I want to help people to consistently take authentic actions and take inspired actions in their lives and in their work. Because if they consistently take inspired, authentic action, they're going to create lives and businesses that they love, which transforms their world, which transforms the world, which transforms my world. And so for me, the reason I sit here at this little bitty desk in this tiny little bedroom in a two-bedroom apartment is because I want to consistently give people the opportunity to recognize the internal disproportionate misinformed resistance they have, to help them to change their identity, to see themselves as they truly are, so they're able to make good, thoughtful choices every single day. And not every single choice, but doing that more consistently. And so everything that I am currently building in my business, there's a new product line that's being launched in the next 6 weeks. I'm actually bringing my sister on as a full-time employee to free me up from the administration so that I can be more client-facing in the work that we do, because there's only so many minutes in the day, to just help people to do that, to find that disproportionate misinformed thought that's rattling around in your head that you picked up somewhere along the way that is preventing you from transforming your identity into who you truly want to be. And if we do that, then everything else just kind of takes care of itself.
That's so simple and so beautiful. So thank you so much for sharing your knowledge and your wisdom and actually your heart with us on RebCat. Where can people find you?
Easiest way to find me is tappingqanda.com. It's spelled TAPPINGQANDA.com. Or if you just search my first name, Gene, and the word tapping, I have a very, very large digital footprint. It's actually hard for you to miss me. Recently, an old family friend tracked me down. And he's like, I was trying to find your dad and you're everywhere on the internet. What's your dad's email address? So it's not hard to find me.
So just to improve your life in so many ways. You've heard it, get in touch with Gene. I will leave also that in the show notes. And again, thank you very much for being our guest on the show.
Thanks for the opportunity. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to the RebChat Inside Stories series. We hope you enjoyed it. To feature your inside story, contact us at www.rebcatcreations.com or follow us on Instagram at RebCat Creations.